Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. My guest today is the wacky, obscene, satirical writer Sam Lipsight. His new book is The Ask, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, a wild and sometimes ugly comic novel about what happens when the bottom falls out at the cultural fundraising office of a mediocre college. He's the author, as well, in reverse order, of Homeland, The Subject Steve, and Venus Drive. Now, what interests me is that starting, I think, with Animal House, critics writing about movies, about the world in which chaos rules and the most chaotic is king, they started calling them sweating warthog movies. And to some extent, Sam Lipsight writes sweating warthog novels. They're about being angry, about being smart, funny, witty, scabrous, clever, and caught in a culture that no longer values or treasures those things. These books are attempts to rescue the category of loser as something other than the accusation it's turned into in our time.
I think that we've lost the sense that the loser, by which I mean anyone who is marginalized in some way or feels outside of the machine of culture, politics, and you know, loser must include some of the great prophets of the Bible as well. But we've forgotten that we can get sort of truths from these voices. We've forgotten that we can get a perspective on the way we live our lives that we don't necessarily get from the voices that are at the center of discussion and that tend to cast the aspersion loser and other words like that.
Now, I have to say that Sam's books scare me because they are terrifically funny, but they're books that don't provide an escape exit. You know, if you're caught, you're caught. And yet, people reading them, or at least recently people reading them, are beginning to discover how funny they are. I want to read the first paragraph of a terrific review, the kind that I hope makes a writer glow. This is by Jennifer Schussler, and it appeared in the New York Review of Books. If you've heard anything about Sam Lipsight, you've probably heard that he's funny. Scabrously, deliriously, yourself funny. His characters would no doubt find a dirtier and funnier way of putting it. Drawing audible snorts even from the kind of people, such as the people in his novels, who are way too cool to laugh out loud. In three previous books of fiction, Lipsight has established himself as the poet laureate of overeducated American loserdom, celebrating the putatively more honest inner lives of those who did not pan out. Now, is this you?
Well, I can't think it's me right now because I'm on your show, Michael. So how could a loser be on your show?
Oh, no. This is the home.
But no, I'm joking. There's always emotional autobiography in this work and then a lot of distortion and a lot of bending of facts. So I tend to say that none of it is autobiographical except for all of it. Mm-hmm. And there's that weird kind of blurry place where all of this kind of occurs. And I think that, at least for me, it's always been my books, my writing, they're always a product of everything I've thought, felt, read, experienced, heard secondhand, and it sort of all goes into this kind of whirling machine.
Now tell me, Did you study with Gordon Lish?
I did, yeah.
Okay. Because I was told by other people who studied with Gordon, in a certain way, he was the king editor. And he came to give writing classes that became famous for going on all night. And he would tell his writers, it's no longer time to pussyfoot. You're either on the boat or you're off it. Most writers drown and are never heard of. We need a book that grabs you by the throat from the first line, and you don't have room to be boring or unaggressive. Did that have a big effect on you?
Yeah, well, most of what Gordon said had a big effect. I mean, he was a wonderful teacher. That was really one of the biggest lessons, from the first line. And it doesn't, you know, there's a certain sense in which I chose to be aggressive in my sentence making from the get-go, but you can do it in a quiet, seductive way as well. But you need to be doing something striking that so that the reader opens the book and immediately senses that something different is happening here.
Well, it seems appropriate that we hear the beginning of Sam Lipsyte's novel, The Ask, right now.
Okay. America, said Horace, the office temp, was a run-down and demented pimp. Our republic's whoremaster days were through. Whither that frost-nerved, diamond-fanged hustler who'd stormed Normandy, smacked the Soviets, turned out such firm emerging market flesh? Now our nation slumped in the corner of the pool hall, some gummy coot with a pint of Mad Dog and soggy yellow eyes, just another mark for the juvenile wolves. We're the bitches of the first world, said Horace, his own eyes braziers of delight. We all loved Horace, his clownish pronouncements. He was a white kid from Armonk who had learned to speak and feel from a half-dozen VHS tapes in his father's garage. Besides, here at our desks with our turkey wraps, I did not disagree. But I let him have it. It was my duty. We were in what they call a university setting, a bastion of, etc. Little did I know this was my last normal day, it said Bastion, that my old friend Purdy was about to butt back into my world, mangle it. I just figured this was what my worst teachers used to call a teachable moment. Horace, I said, that's a pretty sexist way to frame a discussion of America's decline, don't you think? Not to mention racist. I didn't mention anybody's race, said Horace. You didn't have to, I said. PC robot, said Horace. Fascist dupe. Did you get avocado on yours? Fattening, I said. Don't worry, baby, said Horace. I like big women. What about hairy ones, I said, parted my shirt to air my nipple fuzz. Horace let me be a cretin with him. You could call him my infantilism provider, though you'd sound like an idiot. Otherwise, I was ostensibly upstanding, a bald husband, a slab-bellied father. Gentlemen, said our supervisor, Vargina, coming out from her command nook, did you send off those emails about the Belgian art exchange? Horace swiveled back to his monitor with the mock panic of a sitcom surf. Vargina took scant notice of our talk, tolerated foul banter for purposes of morale, but the fact remained we had forgotten the afternoon's assignment. The gods of task flow did not easily forgive.
Sam Lipsyte, reading from The Ask, published by Farrah, Straus & Giroux. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. The narrator says he comes in between meaning periods in the culture, and every culture has, you know, I guess Foucault called them shifts in
epistemic shifts.
And there used to be simpler words for it.
Right, exactly.
Times change might be the simpler words. But what does he say about the periods he comes between?
Well, he was talking about the death of analog and the beginning of aggressively marketed nachos, I think, was sort of when he came of age, yeah.
Yeah, and there he is. He's one of... Perhaps some people are already saying one of the most unpleasant narrators you'll ever meet. Other people are saying lovably unpleasant. And one and the same time, he has the impulse to correct his colleague, the temp worker, Horace, who someone else refers to as Horace. and to launch his own invectives that are no less palatable than the ones he attacks.
Right, exactly. There's a bit of hypocrisy there, but
the hypocrite, or at least the neo-hypocrite, the person who wants to at the same time attack the culture, attack himself, find self-pity a hideous alternative, indulge in it secretly,
sure,
and constantly. These are the non-places these characters occupy.
Yeah, well, I think this is when we talk about the dimensionality of a character, that's what I'm interested in. So we can imagine in our lives being filled with self-loathing, filled with loathing for the culture, seeking some sort of meaning and deliverance, yet also believing there's no meaning and no chance for deliverance. It's what being human is all about. It's that seeking that's somehow suffused with also with a sadness and also with a hopelessness that's also wrapped in hope. And I think it's, you know, he's a character who's trying to navigate these things. And sometimes, in that journey, he can be unpleasant. And when people say lovably unpleasant, that may be their enjoying the book. They're enjoying the language of the book. They're enjoying the characters there. And so there's this notion that, well, he must be sympathetic because I'm still reading it.
It's kind of movie talk, movie story conference talk, actually, that sentence that begins, I don't care about this guy. He's a loser.
Right.
And we who read novels always throw up our hands because we know that novels are about people facing adversities that are adversities because they do defeat the people. In other words,
right,
there has to be a suitable antagonist.
Well, absolutely. And I think that, the novel is about consciousness, right? And so on some level. And so who has time to really work through all of that stuff but the person who's been knocked on his ass and is sitting there thinking about how did I get here?
Absolutely. Now, your character, whose name is Milo, has just been very quickly fired from his job,
right,
and then reinstated because an
provisionally,
old,
yeah.
Provisionally. He can earn his job back at no pay if he can solicit a donation large enough from a man named Purdy Stewart. Purdy Stewart has all the money in the world, it seems, and a lot of charisma to fling around. He's an old college friend of Milo's, and Milo can get his job back if he can get Purdy to donate enough money to the thing that Milo refers to, Mediocre University of the City of New York. do I have the title of that?
It's the Mediocre University at New York City.
Distinctions are constantly being made in the book between in and of, in line and online.
Right, exactly.
Why those distinctions? Is it because argument can be had about anything, even points of grammar in this world?
Well, I think that's true. But I also think that sometimes points of grammar are important because they indicate larger shifts going on in the way people regard the world and in the way very common things are generally are understood.
You also have a great ear for profanity. What about the people, the readers, who want to leave the room when it gets too much for them?
Well, I haven't seen anybody leave the room during a reading.
Uh-huh.
I guess if you're in the safety of your own home, you can just put the book down and, as Edward Dahlberg said, read something else. But
I've been at places where, say, Sandra Bernhardt has caused Republicans
right.
to leave the room when she has said something extravagantly funny to the rest of us. I mean, is your answer to them, well, bleep them?
Yeah, sure, bleep it.
Yeah.
Bleep it in your head if you have your own bleeper.
Uh-huh.
And I think people do that anyway. Do they hear what they want to hear?
But is a novelist trying to make friends?
No, not at all. I mean, a novelist is trying to present an example of consciousness, I think, as I was talking about before, and use language to tell a story.
Who are your gods?
I guess I had grown up in high school reading a lot of realist stories, Raymond Carver, that sort of thing was – and it was very compelling. But it was running into writers like the recently departed Barry Hanna and people like Stanley Elkin who really kind of showed me what you could do, that there was so much you could do with language and still write the story and still have characters doing things. You could create a poetic novel, and that to me was just a really exciting, revelatory notion.
And also the poetry of the crass.
Yes.
The poetry of the lowdown.
Absolutely.
Of the sales pitch.
Right. And that's the – I love the way Elkin, you know, dealt with people's work and the language of their work and the way Hanna – you know, in a strange way, I was a Jewish kid growing up in New Jersey, so I didn't really understand half the stuff Hanna was talking about in terms of the South or what it meant to be Southern. I didn't connect to that at all, but I was just connecting to the way he smashed words together and the way he created these explosive phrases and these beautiful trailing off moments too. And Elkin, you know, I maybe felt a bit more of a cultural affinity with Elkin, but, you know, also it was about the way he was able to seize upon somebody's life through their everyday struggles, through their work and things like that, that struck me, but used, you know, almost Shakespearean language to render it.
But I hear Lenny Bruce here too, or is that inevitable?
Yeah, probably filtered through some others that I haven't really formulated for myself, but. Sure, Lenny Bruce is, I think, you know, it's like saying Brando had an effect on acting in a way.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Sam Lipsight, author most recently of The Ask, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We'll continue after a break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Sam Lipsight about his book, The Ask, a seriously funny novel about a man who's so miserable about most things in life that he's vicious, surly, and angry at everyone. But like many such heroes, it's because he's philosophically looking for the right way to live. A possibility that may have bailed out of the cultural airplane quite a few years ago. So like the hero of any satirical novel, whether it's Candide or Miss Lonely Hearts, he's been brokenhearted by the fact that his expectations about life lie in ruins all around him, and he doesn't see the possibility of new heroes to put in the place of the old heroes.
Sure. There's definitely he's someone who grew up with certain expectations for himself, where his place could be in society, and it hasn't really come to fruition. And part of it, though, I should say he studied to be a painter, and that didn't work out. And so he's now working at a school helping to raise money for young people who resemble himself at that age. And so he kind of has a bit of resentment for them, but also sadness about that whole trajectory. There are also scenes, though, in the book where it becomes clear that these expectations were not just fed him. He wasn't fed these entirely, but he misheard a lot of things. And I think that we all do that to some degree, is we hear what we want to hear about what our potential is and what we're going to be able to do or how we're going to be able to live or what, you know, what what fate will have in store for us. And that sort of helps us work day to day. But then when the day comes when we realize these things haven't occurred, that can be heartbreaking.
And all of the characters in this book are, well, there are no good guys.
There are no good guys, but I would say there are no bad guys necessarily either. Purdy, at times people have told me that they think Purdy is more sympathetic than Milo, which I found interesting but also understand to some degree.
Well, let's ask about that, because everyone in the book speaks a very aggressive language that sounds kind of like heckling. It's like a book populated by the progeny of Don Rickles.
Maybe that's just what it's like inside my head. It's just a lot of Don Rickles.
Well, I also wondered, is it what it's like, or what you see it's like in America now?
I think there's a certain aggressivity to American dynamics, to American speech and the dynamics of people interacting. I think that, people are stating their case, dismantling your case, staking some territory, whether it's through humor or insult or in any case, they're trying to clear some space in the cacophony for themselves. And I think that that's sort of what maybe you're hearing a bit in the book.
Well, most of the time, satiric novels, I'm thinking primarily of Candide, but there is a moral. It's a moral you don't want to hear, which is stop believing in optimism. Stop thinking that there's a sunny side to everything, accepting the grimness of what's around. And maybe this is our human state, that no matter what we do, we manage yet again in another generation to find a way not to accept the grimness of the culture around us. But what would it be for you?
Well, it's not far off. I think that it's in response to the notion that we're entitled to happiness. And how could that be? How could we be entitled to happiness? But I think to put a slightly sunnier spin on the Candide moral, I think that with that resignation, that understanding, that acceptance of certain kinds of grim conditions that are out of your control, and I think this is bears out for Milo at the end of this book, there you can still find glimmers in small ways of a better future for yourself. And you can also do things on a daily basis that won't cause so much pain. And I think in a sense, I don't want to ruin the ending, but in a sense, he's – by getting rid of a lot of those expectations that he had heaped upon himself, he is able to find a certain kind of relief and also be a better, for instance, father.
One of my favorite sections of the book comes when – Milo recognizes that he and his wife don't even watch movies together. Can you sort of describe, it's a intimate bedtime sort of reconciliation conversation?
Yeah, well, Milo talks about this, pretty awful romantic comedy from the 90s called Caller I Do, which I made up, but I always thought it would be a great title for a romantic comedy of the mid-90s. It was a movie that they could hate together.
And he says
that. We used to hate that together. And she says, well, maybe we can get back to that place. And I think that's maybe modern intimacy, too. Yeah.
And nevertheless, he cries when he watches.
Yeah, he does.
And hates crying.
And hates himself for crying, yeah.
Now, that seems to me to be a Sam Lipsight cycle of emotions. to see something that moves you to tears, to get angry that you're crying, to get angry at tears and the things that manipulate them.
Yeah.
What's left standing?
What's left standing? Good question. I think that you are actually the one who has gone through that cycle. You get actually several shots at catharsis, both from the movie and from going through all of the feelings about yourself and your reaction, your anger at society for creating an art that can manipulate you that way, can also take you into maybe clearer ways, clearer modes of understanding your predicament. So it's a painful and pathetic place to be, but maybe it has its positive outcome.
Characters learning that they have an affection for the things they hate, that they have built a life out of important decisions, like whether to have avocado on the turkey wrap or not, and that these might be just what we have, and the author seems to join them by saying, yes, and if you can make hilarious sentences out of these problems, you may, even if life fails you, create a really funny and interesting novel.
That's my hope, yeah. This goes back to people perhaps saying, well, the book's so bleak.
Yeah.
And why? How could you write such a bleak book? Although I think it's not as bleak as people say it is, and I think the humor counters that a lot. My response is still the response of the fact that it exists means it's not that bleak, because if things were that bleak, there'd be no reason to write a book. And the great books that we love that perhaps have grim messages, if things were truly grim, we'd all just commit suicide. We wouldn't go on, and we wouldn't write books and or make art or have discussions or try to get to the matterful places in these questions. And I kept thinking of something what Donald Barthelme once wrote about Beckett, which was the fact that the books were written is a celebration of life. And if you can't see that, then you're not getting the point.
I've been talking with Sam Lipsyte, author most recently of The Ask, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you, Sam, for joining me.
Thank you so much, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Ask at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.